The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Corner, weighing in with his take on current events, the smarty of the party, the mighty mite from the right, the heavyweight of debate, the man who's in cahoots with the grassroots, the broadcaster master, Jimmy Sangenberger.
Saturday night is always all right for the Jimmy Sangenberger Show right here on News Talk 710 KNUS. And such a pleasure and a privilege it is to be back with you once again. Thanks so much for joining us, being a part of the program. Few ways to get in touch with yours truly, 24/7, 365. At Sang Center on Twitter is one way to go. That's Sang with an E, not an A, Center on Twitter. You can also email me via the 710KNUS website, 710KNUS.com. Go to the Jimmy Sangenberger Show page. You can access podcasts going back years right there. And you can also email me directly. Plus, of course, there's my personal website, JimmySangenberger.com. Remember, there's no A, there's no I, there's no U in Sangenberger. It's all E's all the time. Once you know that, Sangenberger is easy. Log on there, go to the contact page, and you can email yours truly that way as well. Such a pleasure and a privilege, once again, to be with you. And we've got quite a show tonight. At the bottom of the hour, I'll be sharing with you an interview I did this week with Keith Nobles, who's a good friend of this program. He is author of the novel Our Dogs Did Not Bark, a politically incorrect dystopian tale. He's a constitutional conservative, and he is a Cherokee Nation citizen. Keith joined me yesterday on my web show in partnership with the Washington Examiner, Jimmy at the Crossroads, to offer a Cherokee's perspective on the Supreme Court's significant decision this past Wednesday regarding Indian lands, particularly in Oklahoma, saying half the state of Oklahoma is Indian territory. But what are the implications of this? What does that mean, particularly in the real world, so to speak? We will talk with Keith Nobles. I'll share that interview in just a bit. Plus, I'll be joined by Courtney O'Reilly with Tax Help Colorado to talk a little bit about tax day that's coming up this Wednesday, and particularly resources available for folks who are in need and also wondering, do I need to file? Questions like that. We have brief conversation with Tax Help Colorado's Courtney O'Reilly about that coming up a little later in this hour. Also, next hour, I'll be joined by Corey DeAngelis, who is the director of school choice at the Reason Foundation. He wrote a really good piece worth checking out for Reason magazine entitled "Don't Force Schools to Reopen, but Don't Force Families to Pay for Closed Schools." Right on the money there, particularly this part about not forcing families to pay for closed schools. Seems like common sense. We'll delve into that with Corey DeAngelis and the topic of school choice in the next hour. Plus, Jeff Crump will drop by, talk about the life and legacy of Charlie Daniels in a special Music with Crump segment. We lost a great, a legend and a true patriot, an incredible musician. And I wanted to pay tribute to the great and now late Charlie Daniels. We will do that with Jeff Crump coming up in the second hour as well. Plus, the Electoral College, we had a number of significant rulings by the Supreme Court on several different cases this term, and even just this past week alone. And so earlier this week, when the Electoral College ruling came down on the faithless electors, putting Colorado right into the national headlines along with Washington State, because we had an elector who was penalized for going against his pledge to vote for Hillary Clinton, wanted to vote for John Kasich, was removed by the Colorado Department of State. Wayne Williams, then Secretary of State, was removed from that post because he violated his pledge. Well, the Supreme Court took up the question of whether or not someone could be penalized, an elector to the Electoral College could be penalized for, against the law of their state, saying, nope, I'm not going to vote for the presidential candidate to whom I am pledged as an elector. They're called faithless electors. Well, the Supreme Court said, yes, you may penalize such individuals. So this week I caught up with DU law professor Robert Hardaway. Spoke with him about that. I'm going to share that interview in the third hour. Fascinating conversation, fascinating topic. Plus, this can have some implications on the national popular vote effort. We talked a bit about that this week on my web show in partnership with the Washington Examiner, Jimmy at the Crossroads, with Trent England, executive director of Save Our States. I'll share that interview as well coming up in the third hour of tonight's show. A fascinating conversation you do not want to miss. So, tonight, lots happening. Keith Nobles, Courtney O'Reilly, Corey DeAngelis, Jeff Crump, Professor Robert Hardaway, and Trent England, all on tonight's edition of the Jimmy Sangenberger Show here, News Talk 710 KNUS. But first, I want to get into some thoughts on a few different topics that have been on my mind this week. One of them, this is more of a national discussion, then we'll get local. We'll get to the mask topic in a moment. But I want to start by sharing with you some sound of Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York State just this week arguing that President Trump does not have the authority, as he has said he would like to do, to force states to reopen their schools.
And I heard what the president said on schools, but this has been there, done that, right? School reopenings are a state decision, period. That is the law, and that is the way we're going to proceed. It's not up to the president of the United States. There is something called the Constitution that guides government power. And then there are a series of laws that are based on that constitution. And the president does not have the authority to open schools.
The president does not have the authority to open schools. There's this thing called the Constitution. He went a step further in his press conference as well.
Just to be clear, the federal government has no legal authority when it comes to school openings.
The federal government has no legal authority when it comes to school openings. He didn't just say President Trump. He said the federal government. Keep in mind, there are three branches to the federal government. The executive branch, that's the president. The legislative branch, that's Congress. And the Supreme Court, that is to say the judicial branch, headed by the Supreme Court. Those are the three branches of the federal government. We're not talking just about the president here. What I find striking is when Democrats talk about how the federal government has no legal authority on something, particularly when it involves a direction to the states by, wait for it, a Republican president, particularly a Republican president named Donald J. Trump. Is this some kind of great constitutional awakening that we're seeing among Democrats who are talking more about this thing called the Constitution and states' rights and the 10th Amendment and limits on federal government authority? Is this a great constitutional awakening that we are now seeing among the Democrats? Probably not. There's not really a doubt in my mind saying that. Okay, not. But let's put this to a test for a moment. Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York says President Trump, and interestingly, more broadly, the federal government, has no authority to force schools to reopen by tying money to reopening. Well, Mr. Cuomo, I have a question for you, one of the apparent leaders of this great constitutional awakening among the Democrats in this country. Where does the federal government get its authority to even have a Department of Education in the first place? Where in the Constitution does it authorize the existence of a Department of Education in the first place? Inquiring minds want to know, because I cannot find it anywhere in this thing called the Constitution. I have looked, and I have not found it. It's not very long. It's not hard to find that power. It's not there. So would Governor Cuomo please tell us where that power is? And if he can't find it, does he agree with me that the Federal Department of Education should not exist? And that education is much better left to the states to make these kinds of determinations, all sorts of determinations, instead of having a federal bureaucracy? Well, we're waiting for an answer from Governor Cuomo that will probably never come. Let's start reopening the damn schools. Not everywhere, maybe, not in all cases, but broadly speaking, let's do it. Later on, when we talk with Corey DeAngelis of the Reason Foundation, we'll talk about this, but particularly look at the fact that parents are paying, taxpayers are paying for schools that may not open. And parents are being told, well, you just have to get daycare or do whatever to take care of your children. Or if you'd like to send them to school, like say a private school, government's not going to help you. Because the Democrats oppose school choice. And they don't want the money to follow the student. So they want taxpayers to keep paying for schools that do not open, reopen, while simultaneously telling those very same taxpayers who are also parents, you have to figure out stuff for your kids. We'll try remote education for the students. Never mind that it didn't work well this semester, this previous semester. We're still going to look at our options. If we're not reopening the schools, here's what we might do. And you're going to have to like it. Or maybe you won't like it, but you're going to have to accept it. That is the nature of these government officials right now in the Democratic Party across the country. That's where we're at. In just a moment here on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show, a News Talk 710 KNUS, I'm going to offer up some thoughts on the growing mask mandates here in Colorado, particularly in the Denver metro area. But first, a little bonus bumper here from blind Mississippi Morris, who's going back to Louisiana. Thank you. I just dig that hard-nosed blues harp from the great blind Mississippi Morris as we continue moving along on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show. So great to be with you. Thanks for joining us, being a part of the program. So, I live in Aurora, in Arapahoe County. And Tri-County Health Department is the group of unelected public health bureaucrats that have say over issues like COVID-19 regulations, unless, of course, the governor preempts them. Now, Tri-County Health is already an entity that I have said my county of Arapahoe should withdraw from. And this past week, that opinion was just reaffirmed all the more strongly because of an unnecessary mask mandate that Tri-County Health has put forward for Arapahoe, Douglas, and Adams counties. And by the way, that order was put forward without actually providing language. They said that counties and municipalities could withdraw from this order and say, no, we're not going to do it. They could opt out. That's the proper phrase. They could opt out. And Douglas County's commissioners are opting out, and they are now moving forward, as I understand it, to develop a plan to remove Douglas County from Tri-County Health Department altogether. Just as I have for months now called upon the Arapahoe County commissioners to do. At a minimum, I would like to see Arapahoe County commissioners, particularly the three Republicans on the five-member board, Jeff Baker, Kathleen Conte, and Nancy Sharp, opt Arapahoe out of this order from Tri-County Health Department, and ultimately withdraw Arapahoe from Tri-County Health. I don't like the idea of these unelected public health bureaucrats who already have proven themselves narrowly focused in very specific ways. That is to say, COVID-19, regardless of the consequences of their policies. I don't think that those unelected bureaucrats should have this much power. Look, I'm not opposed to masks, generally speaking. I will go into certain places and make sure that I'm wearing a mask for my reasons of wanting to, whether it's because I feel like, okay, this is an incident, it's instance of very close proximity, and it might help to actually slow or stop the spread or prevent spread of this virus, so I'm going to do it. Or maybe it's I'm going to try and make other people feel comfortable in a store, for example. I may wear a mask for whatever impetus I've got to do so. 80%+, for example, in the city of Aurora, which looks like it's on the road to adopting a mask mandate, even though part of Aurora is in Douglas County, by the way. 80%+ compliance rate of those people in Aurora acting simply at the request, the behest of the government. Not an order, but the request. As I understand it, we have not, since the beginning of May, had more than 10 people hospitalized in any of these three counties at any given time because of COVID-19. The idea that we need to have the government step in for this kind of mandate is ludicrous. If a business wants to require masks to come in, fine and dandy. I will do it if they insist upon it, because I believe in property rights. And I believe that a business should be able to deny service to someone who doesn't come in with a mask if they think they should wear a mask into their establishment. But that doesn't mean that the all-knowing, all-powerful bureaucrats should be making these kinds of decisions, by the way, without actually presenting language for the order in the first place. Remember Pelosi? We have to pass the bill to find out what's in it vis-a-vis Obamacare. Kind of thinking the same thing's going on here. We got to pass the order before we find out what the language actually says. Nobody knows how this is going to be enforced. It's superfluous, that is to say, it is unnecessary. It's already being done by most people. And Colorado is not seeing any kind of a surge because people have been taking personal responsibility in many different circumstances and complying with the requests. My gosh, do we really need this nanny state here? Is this really what we need in the state of Colorado and in Arapaho, Adams, Douglas, other counties in the Denver metro area? I don't think so. And once again, that's why, at least in my territory, my county, I'm saying pull out of Tri-County Health and at the very least opt out of this superfluous, unnecessary order. I could go on, but we got to run to a break. Here's Joe Bonamassa doing the James Bond tune on Her Majesty's Secret Service with the Sleep Easies. Here on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show, we will be back next segment. Keith Nobles, my interview on the Supreme Court decision regarding Indian Territory in Oklahoma. Keep it right here. It's the Jimmy Sangenberger Show, News Talk 710 KNUS. We're back, Jimmy Sangenberger Show, News Talk 710 KNUS. Little Joe Bonamassa singing about living in that dust bowl. Thanks for joining us, being a part of the program. So, just yesterday was Free to Choose Friday on my web show in partnership with the Washington Examiner called Jimmy at the Crossroads. And I caught up with good friend of this very show, Keith Nobles, author of the novel Our Dogs Did Not Bark, a politically incorrect dystopian tale. He is a member, rather a citizen, of the Cherokee Nation. And we got his take on the show about the Supreme Court's decision this week in McGirt v. Oklahoma. Pretty significant case. And here is my interview with Keith Nobles from Friday's Jimmy at the Crossroads. McGirt v. Oklahoma. You are a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, so you have a strong interest in this. I know you've been to Oklahoma many times. I want to ask you right off the bat to set the table for us before we get into any opinions and some of the implications. Set the table for us on this decision and what it entails. And I know that this goes back to really gives, you know, a couple hundred years of history in the mix.
Yeah, and as you know, I've spoken and written about this very issue for a very long time. So go back, roll back to the Constitution being adopted, roll back to George Washington being the first president. The parts here of the Constitution that are relevant to this case, to this matter, are Article 1, which is the sovereignty of the nations, that Indian nations should be self-governing under the Constitution, and Article 6, which are treaties are the law of the land. So these are the guardrails. George Washington, being the first president, had the first Indian policy, and that Indian policy was he invited Indians into the family. He invited Indians in to become Americans. This is very important. So as a Cherokee, the Cherokee Nation, we were the first tribe to accept this offer. We sent Major Ridge, a prominent Cherokee, to the White House in 1807, and he told Thomas Jefferson, "We accept your offer to become Americans." And from that point on, Cherokees clung to being Americans. So this offer extended through the early presidencies, the early administrations, for Indians to become Americans. And this was the American policy. Andrew Jackson revoked that policy, revoked that offer. Now, this is why Indians do not like Andrew Jackson, because Andrew Jackson basically said, "I take the offer to become Americans off the table. You cannot be Americans. You can never be Americans," was essentially the message. Okay, so from this point, we deviated from the Constitution in regard to Indians. And it was one bad idea replacing the unintended consequences of the previous bad idea. Well, the relevant piece of this decision yesterday goes back to the Curtis Act that was passed in 1898. And what they tried to do, essentially the Curtis Act tried to abolish Indians as a legal status. That was the essence of it. And in doing that, it basically destroyed tribal governments, the ability to govern yourselves, et cetera, et cetera. What happened yesterday was the Supreme Court ruling that essentially the remnants of that law were unconstitutional. I mean, that's the essence of it. So some of the Curtis Act had been rolled back by Richard Nixon, thankfully. Some of it was rolled back in previous court cases like Harjo v. Kleppe. But what happened yesterday was significant. It was something I never thought I would see in my life. It was a Supreme Court Justice, Gorsuch, looking at the Constitution, taking it at its word, Article 1 and Article 6, looking at the treaty that was signed, and taking the treaty as word and saying, well, this is what it is. There's no fooling around here. There's no trying to mitigate what it is. And so it was very much a return to the Constitution. We have not seen that in a very, very long time.
Now, Keith, what do you make, though, of the fact that it was Gorsuch aligned with the four liberals on the bench, and you have Clarence Thomas, Justice Alito, Justice Kavanaugh, and Chief Justice Roberts all aligned in opposition and dissenting from this particular decision? Because it was 5-4, but it was interesting lines drawn in terms of the ideological makeup. And you normally would find certainly Justice Thomas on the side of the Constitution. So what makes you think that they were wrong?
Well, so I can tell you here. I think the four justices who sided with Gorsuch probably did the right thing for the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm. But this is really interesting. And this is what was – I wrote about this at some length when Gorsuch was nominated to the court. Gorsuch understands Indian law. He's well-versed in Indian law. He is probably the best-versed justice in Indian law that the Supreme Court has seen since the Marshall Court 190 years ago. Justice Scalia, who I have tremendous respect for, Justice Scalia once said, when it comes to Indian law, we're just making it up as we go. This is, for if you're an Indian, this is obviously a very important thing. For 98% of Americans, it's trivial. It's not important to them at all. And really, why should it be? It's not something they deal with or think of. And so from a point of view of judges, there are very few judges who are versed in Indian law, very few judges on the federal bench who have any experience in Indian law. Gorsuch, fortunately, is one of the very few, and he was appointed to the Supreme Court. What Gorsuch did was follow the Constitution, and hats off to him for that. Understanding the intricacies here of what are 190 years of horrible federal policy in regard to Indians and avoiding the Constitution. And he took the step back to say, we're going to follow the Constitution here. Whereas John Roberts took a more practical view of, well, these are all the bad things or unintended consequences that could happen from this decision. Gorsuch said, this is what the Constitution says. This is what the treaty says. There's no ambiguity here. This is what we'll do.
Again, Keith Noble's our guest, a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, joining us here on Jimmy at the Crossroads once again. So let's talk about some of the implications of this decision. What does this mean? I mean, as we were talking about with our previous guest, Zach Smith of the Heritage Foundation, legal fellow there, this is particularly narrowly tailored towards criminal law and enforcing criminal laws on the Indian territory and the Indian reservation. Land that now is about half of Oklahoma under this ruling. So what do you view as the implications of this from a practical standpoint, from specifically what this ruling is about? And then we'll get to some of the implications moving forward.
Okay, so it's even narrower than that, Jimmy, in that it only applies to the five tribes. So as I mentioned before, George Washington invited Indian nations in to become Americans. Well, before Andrew Jackson revoked that decision, there were five nations that accepted that offer. Mm-hmm. The Cherokee, Choctaw, Chickasaw, Seminole, and Creek, who are Muscogee Indians, the five tribes. So those five tribes are the only people that this decision applies to. There's 39 Indian nations just in Oklahoma. There's nearly 600 throughout the nation. It only applies to those five tribes. So it's even narrower than just law enforcement. It's law enforcement for those five tribes. But here's what's important, I think. There's a lot of almost hyperbole about what could change here. In practicality, I think very little is going to change. What has happened here since 1907 is that the state has been able to dictate these matters to the five tribes. Cherokee, Chickasaw, Choctaw, Seminole, and Creek. What this decision does is it removes the ability of the state to have to be able to dictate law enforcement matters to these nations. It requires the state and the nations to sit down and negotiate what they're going to do. And so it's a wonderful thing that there'll be cooperation here where there was not cooperation before. And that's a good thing for everyone all the way around. Now, I don't think in practical terms, anything's really going to change here in terms of law enforcement. So, and you're into things that most people have no experience with. But for these five Indian nations, they have tribal law enforcement. There is also within their territory, state law enforcement, state police. And then there's local law enforcement for the cities and the counties. Generally speaking, the state, local, and tribal law enforcement, they're already all cross-badged. They're already all cooperating on that level. The only thing here that could change would be the judicial system. And it's highly unlikely that is going to change much. It is probable the tribes will accede to the local courts and sure. The state court continuing to prosecute these cases. But the thing is, they have a voice here. What's been returned to them that the Curtis Act took away is their ability to say no. They have now the ability to say no if they want to.
So you're suggesting here, Keith Nobles, that the practical impact of this decision in accordance with what it actually addresses isn't going to be significant in terms of day-to-day life changes. But what's significant is how Indians will be treated in terms of their relation with the states and the federal government.
Yes, the Indian nations and the state government will have to cooperate now. Where for 113 years they were dictated to. That's the major difference here. That's the improvement in the situation. That's a major thing. That's a major turnabout in the history of Indian relationships between state and federal government and the Indian nations.
What is the feeling, the sense then for your fellow Cherokee and others of the five nations that are particularly impacted by this decision? Is there great enthusiasm?
Oh, people are ecstatic. People are thrilled. We can have a voice in our affairs that we never had before. And even if what the agreement that we make comes to is nearly identical to what it is now, that's not the point. The point is it's cooperation. It's voluntarily reaching an agreement, not being dictated to. And that makes people very, very happy.
So, Keith Nobles, let me ask you a final question then here for every American who's watching this with intrigue about this changing dynamic here. How does this impact liberty on this Free to Choose Friday? What's notable about this decision in that context, in your view, especially as both an American citizen and a Cherokee citizen?
So we're returning closer to the Constitution of the Indian nations being self-governing. And people tend to be almost hyperbolic that they're going to go off and do things, wild, crazy things with that self-governance. And that's highly unlikely to be what happens. What is going to happen is we'll see a greater degree of cooperation here between tribal governments, state governments, local governments. That is what is going to happen. A lot of the hyperbole is just uncalled for, in my opinion. We are going to see greater cooperation, and as a result of that, what we'll see is local people having a greater voice in how they are governed. I also want to say there's a lot of concerns I hear people mention about land ownership and various things. And the majority of people who live on these tribal lands at this point are not Cherokee, Choctaw, Seminole, Creek, Chickasaw at this point. And we have all lived quite well with our non-Indian neighbors in these territories for a very long time. And so I just don't see any issues there. That's not going to change. What changes here is a greater degree of cooperation between government entities. I think a lot of the concerns are probably uncalled for, as well as your previous guest mentioned maybe 2,000 cases have to be reheard. The Indian nations have voiced a desire that the people who have already been convicted of crimes need to face the justice they've already been sentenced to. So there's no cry here from the Indian nations to release any of these people. Many of these people, like McGirt, was convicted of a horrible crime. And the sense is he needs to serve his sentence, which is like 500 years for this horrible crime. So the idea here that, Indians will argue these people should be freed is that's just not valid.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your insights today here, Keith Nobles. Very fascinating perspective that at least in my circles, you're the only one who could really provide that kind of perspective. And I really appreciate it. It is a unique part of American history, also a very sordid part of American history, to be sure, but unique in terms of the dynamics and the relationships and how this has evolved over time and now where we are at this point in 2020. So I appreciate you joining us in that regard.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jimmy.
Back here on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show. Once again, that was from my web show in partnership with the Washington Examiner, Jimmy at the Crossroads. So tax day is coming upon us this Wednesday, July 15th. You want to make sure that you file your tax returns if your circumstances require it. And you may want to find out a little bit more as to whether or not you should, if you qualify, if you need to. But also, you want to make sure that you get your tax refund if you are due one. I'm pleased to be joined to talk about this by Tax Help Colorado's Courtney O'Reilly joining us to dive in a little bit to making sure that you get your tax refunds and stimulus payments that may be owed to you and that you don't miss this deadline on Wednesday. Courtney, welcome to the Jimmy Sangenberger Show. Good to have you on 710 KNUS.
Thank you so much, Jimmy, for having me. It's an honor to be on.
It's great to have you on. So let's set the table here for just a moment. I mean, tax day is coming up on Wednesday. What do people need to know more than anything else, you think?
I think the really big thing is that there are still free and trustworthy filing services available. So our program, Tax Help Colorado, we provide free tax filing assistance to low to moderate income households across the state. And even though our in-person filing services are currently closed, we've partnered with an amazing nonprofit, Code for America, to provide a remote tax assistance through getyourrefund.org. There you'll be asked to fill out a simple questionnaire, securely upload images of your tax documents and identification documents, and then schedule a call with one of our IRS certified preparers. The other big thing is, I think when most people hear, you know, they might not have to file, they celebrate, they're excited, one less thing they have to worry about. But in actuality, many people who don't have to file have a benefit in filing. So most noticeably this year, the economic impact payments, more commonly referred to as the stimulus payments, are usually accessed by filing a tax return. So you want to make sure to file so that you can get that payment. But in addition, there are also really valuable tax credits, like the earned income credit and the child tax credit, that you may qualify for, even if you just worked a small part-time job during the year. So on average, Colorado families who qualify for these credits get an additional $2,200 back at tax time. So we're talking a lot of money here, and it can be easily missed. Unfortunately, one in four Coloradans who qualify for these credits, they go unclaimed. So that's money left on the table that I know many people can use right now.
Yeah, especially when you're getting to the stimulus payments. I mean, that's an opportunity that is specifically tied to coronavirus. A lot of people who may be set aside because of that and trying to make ends meet, unable to make ends meet perhaps, and they think, I don't need to file. I haven't filed in the past. But if you are not on the IRS system for the past couple of years, then you have to take this step in order to make sure that you get the payments, right?
Absolutely. I think when these type of payments first were announced, there was a lot of confusion around who was going to automatically get them and who needed to take that extra step. And we're still encountering many people who haven't received those stimulus checks just yet. And like you were saying, those are really important payments. So a family of four within the income limits would total $3,400 back. And so without filing a tax return, they might miss that payment. So it's important to make sure you file a tax return. Even if you don't have a filing requirement, go to getyourrefund.org and our IRS certified preparers will be there to help guide you through. Do you just need to file for the stimulus or might you also qualify for some of these other credits?
And I'm sure some people at times think, I don't need to file my return, but they may actually need to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, we've over the last month or so, we've been talking to plenty of people who just call asking about the stimulus payment, saying, no, I don't have to file. I have nothing to file. And then after a conversation, we realized, no, you did have some income during the year. Let's file that. And then all of a sudden they're getting a larger refund than what they anticipated when they first came to us. So it's always important, even if you worked a very small, minimal job during the year, please come to getyourrefund.org to partner with us so that we can help you find those tax refunds for you.
So in terms of helping those who are in lower incomes, I mean, this is an issue. The tax code is so complex. Everybody, it's just hard to make, impossible really to make heads or tails of the tax code, even for people who are deal with taxes quite a bit. It takes a long time to figure some things out. So in terms of helping those who are lower incomes, I think that that's very important because people may have so many questions or be uncertain about things because of that complexity. So just talk to us for a moment about the benefits of what you're doing to be able to help those in lower incomes who may be pulling their hair out sometimes trying to figure out how they can not just get a refund, but make sure that they're doing this properly.
Absolutely. So we know filing taxes can be extremely stressful. And so that's why we want to take some of that stress off of you. Our IRS certified preparers are incredibly dedicated to this. They actually find taxes exciting, which is an interesting trait. But more importantly, when people hear free, I think they question its quality. And what's been wonderful to see is that volunteer tax programs like ours have the highest accuracy rate across all tax preparation industries at 98%. So you're actually more likely to file a correct tax return when you come to us than you do when you go to other paid preparers. And we also know, just especially for low to moderate income families, it's expensive to file taxes. It can cost hundreds of dollars to do that when there are free services available. So if you're making less than $66,000 a year, you qualify for this service. So really encourage people to go to getyourrefund.org to let us help you.
Anything else, Courtney O'Reilly, that folks should know before we let you go?
No, just, actually one last thing. Even though the filing deadline seems like end of the road, you got to file by then. If you're due a refund, you actually have up to 3 years to claim that refund. So even if you miss the Wednesday deadline, still go to getyourrefund.org to see if you may qualify for these credits. And there's no penalty or issue with claiming that after the July 15th deadline.
Courtney O'Reilly with Tax Help Colorado, partnered up with Code for America. Thank you so much for coming on just a few days before tax day to help make sure that folks are able to take advantage of these sorts of opportunities.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
And that wraps up the first hour of the Jimmy Sangenberger Show. Coming up, we'll talk with Corey DeAngelis of the Reason Foundation about the fight to reopen schools in America. Plus, our good friend Jeff Crump drops by to talk about the life and legacy of the great, now late, Charlie Daniels. It's the Jimmy Sangenberger Show. News Talk 710 KNUS. Don't go anywhere.